Women Worldwide with Deirdre Breckenridge introduces incredible stories shared by women across the globe who have experienced the great heights of success and, at times, the agony of defeat. With a vision to impart wisdom and advice on how to tackle barriers and soar to new heights, the show uncovers different perspectives to help you find your inner strength and to power up your own voice so you can excel in life.
Hello and welcome to Women Worldwide. I'm your host, Deirdre Breckenridge. Thanks for tuning into the show. All right, we have a lot to chat about today. Our topic is health and technology, and the expert joining us is Dr. Patricia Sauber. Okay, so Pat is the founder and CEO of The Doctor Weighs In, and she's going to be explaining all about her portal. She is also a board-certified internist and emergency physician with more than 15 years as a physician executive. Pat is a speaker, she's an author, and she serves on many boards, but I'm going to let her tell you more about her story. So, Pat, it's great to have you on my show. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
All right, where to start with you? Okay, maybe just a good general question about you getting into the field of medicine. How did you get started?
I wanted to go to medical school ever since I could remember. Actually, I initially wanted to go to vet school like all little girls do.
Right.
But I changed about the seventh grade to wanting to be a human doctor. And I went to San Jose State and enrolled as pre-med. And my advisor said to me, oh, no, you can't do that. Women don't go to medical school. I didn't actually know it, but it was true. Yeah. So I ended up ultimately getting married after my junior year, transferring to UC Berkeley and going to graduate school in physiologic psychology, which nobody told me was very hard to get into. Men and women had trouble getting into it.
I bet.
But my major advisor said to me, I know you really wanted to go to medical school, and I'm going to help you. So that was my first mentor. So I was very lucky, and indeed, he helped me. I applied to three schools the first year, got rejected so fast I thought I forgot to put the stamp. We used to do mail applications in those days. And stamps, for people who don't remember, were the things you put on the envelope. So I got rejected very fast. And so the next year I got much more serious about it. And they had actually changed the application process. So you could do one application and just click off and pay for as many schools as you wanted to apply for. So I applied to every school that didn't discriminate against people who were over 26. I was 27 at the time.
Goodness.
So, yeah, I applied to 26 schools. I got three interviews and one acceptance at my first choice school, which was UC San Francisco. So I was extremely fortunate.
Oh, well, what a process. Well, so then you went into practicing medicine, but I think you switched to administration. And when you did, what did you learn from working with large employers who purchase healthcare for their employees?
Sure. Well, let me just back up for a second and say I actually trained in internal medicine, did an endocrine fellowship, and then discovered emergency medicine, which was a brand new field at the time, and fell in love with it. And I ended up working at Kaiser Permanente, which was right down the hill from UC San Francisco, as an emergency physician for about 15 years. And I loved it until the very end, when I had this opportunity to become the first director of national accounts for Kaiser. And I didn't actually know much about the role of big companies in our healthcare system. I don't think many doctors at that time knew how important these companies were. So I learned a tremendous amount, not just about employer-purchased healthcare, but how our incredibly complex and now very broken healthcare system works. And I ended up having the good fortune to do a health policy fellowship during those years. So I really became quite aware of how the intersection of business, policy, politics, a little bit of patients, a little bit of doctors ended up shaping the world that we have today in healthcare.
No, that's really interesting. And then somehow, Pat, through all of this, you kind of switched your path again, which is really interesting, and then moved into health tech. So how did you get there, and what interested you the most about technology and becoming a tech entrepreneur?
Well, I'd spent all this time on the business side of medicine. In the last probably 5 or 6 years, I was working for health plans, and I really needed to get away from that world. And
it was time for a break, huh?
It was time for a break, yeah. You know, one of my last jobs at a health plan was helping to squeeze the waste out, you know, trying to bring the cost of healthcare down, mm-hmm. which is painful work.
Very.
And kind of discouraging because in order to do that, it means you're putting into place policies that put those policies between people and what they want to have. They don't necessarily need to have it, but it's what they want to have. And at the same time, the health technology revolution really was starting to take place in Silicon Valley. I live just north of San Francisco. So I ended up going to Singularity University, to something that was at the time called FutureMed, and learning about the potential to really disrupt some of the things in healthcare that need to be disrupted via these technologies. So it was a very exciting time and almost a no-brainer for me to move away from health insurance and into the world of health tech.
Absolutely. Now, how did you hear about FutureMed? Were there colleagues who were talking about it, or did you read about it?
Yeah, it's very funny. I belonged to a leadership program called ABL, and they had a guest speaker. The guest speaker was a doctor named Daniel Kraft, and Daniel is the world's most exciting speaker when it comes to talking about these kinds of new technologies, and he also talks really fast like that. So you have to get your seat. And by the time I got done, I went up to him and I said, "Oh, wow, this is just so interesting. I'd like to, you know, get to know you better. I'd like to, you know, learn about this world." And he said, "Well, you know, I run this thing called FutureMed. So you had to apply," and I applied and I got in and spent a week with, I can't tell you, they had like 80 speakers in a week, and every speaker that nothing could be more exciting than that. Nothing could be more amazing than that. And then the next speaker would come on. So it was really incredible. And for me, you know, life changing, because that's what I decided to do.
Well, that must have been a period of time when you didn't sleep, because I know when you get a lot of exciting information and your brain is going and the light bulbs are going off, it's kind of hard to sort of tone it down and rest and sleep. So this all sounds really exciting. And then somewhere between FutureMed and now, you kind of started a new path producing and curating health media. So let's talk about the doctor weighs in, right?
Yeah, sure. Well, there's actually a connection, because after FutureMed, I started a company called Health Tech Hatch. And what we wanted to do was to help these young companies, these early stage digital entrepreneurs, incorporate the voice of the patient and be more successful. And we started making videos with the entrepreneurs, having them tell their story of what they were doing, how they got there, how they were funded, you know, what they hoped to accomplish. And so we spent, you know, a couple of years going around to a lot of these technology, these areas where there was a big center of this kind of technology, and going to technology conferences like the Consumer Electronics Show. There's a conference called HIMSS where a lot of folks who are engaged in working on these issues attend every year. And so we created this website called Health Tech Hatch and had all the videos. But meanwhile, I'm still running The Doctor Weighs In, which has been my blog for 11 years.
Wow.
I was one of the really early bloggers.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And so we said, well, this doesn't make sense. It turned out we couldn't monetize the other business, the Health Tech Hatch. So we said, well, maybe we should just take what we were doing with Health Tech Hatch and telling these stories about innovations and merge it with The Doctor Weighs In. And that's what we ended up doing a couple of years ago. So we still do stories about health technology and innovation in that area, but we also do stories about all kinds of innovations in pharmacology, innovations in the delivery of healthcare, what's going on that consumers need to know in the area of lifestyle. So we have a huge range of topics that we cover, and we've been fortunate that over the years, we've attracted a lot of people who either want to write for us regularly or submit guest posts. We probably get, two or three guest posts coming in over the transom. I'm reminded that people don't really know what transoms are anymore, but they upload them on our website. And so that allows us to have, you know, a pretty good variety of stories. And it keeps me interested because I started out being in love with medicine. And all these years later, I'm still in love with medicine because I was able to go, you know, move on when what I was doing wasn't challenging enough or wasn't as exciting as I wanted to be. So there was kind of a method in what sounds like sort of madness of my career.
Well, there's always madness in everyone's career, but it's so refreshing to hear you say how much you still love medicine and what you're doing. Is your site, because you said you're learning too. So is the site more for patients, or do you actually think that doctors and maybe medical students are learning too from what other doctors and medical students are writing?
Right. So we do have one area of our site that we know attracts consumers in particular, and that's lifestyle. So a lot of things about diet, exercise, weight loss, and things like that. But we have also medical students who write for us, and we've just been republishing a series of essays that we published a couple of years ago by people who were first and second year medical students at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. They're all now either in practice or residents or fellows, and they've updated their stories and we've republished them. So we know that appeals to medical students and pre-meds, but we have lots of doctors who write for us too, and they write stories sometimes aimed at consumers and sometimes aimed at doctors. And we promote all our stories, so we're not trying to be like a newspaper where you would come and, you know, read our site cover to cover, because we have something like 2,000 stories on the site. Wow. Rather, we promote the stories using social media and other mechanisms. So each individual story kind of becomes a destination on its own.
That's great. And what do you think are some of the most popular topics, whether it's a consumer topic or it's a medical student topic?
Sure. Well, it kind of varies. We have one writer who is an MD, PhD, who loves to write about the biology, really the neuroanatomy and physiology of behavior. So what are the brain changes that take place, or the brain structures and chemicals that actually determine our behavior? And he'll write, you know, a lot of stories, including he's written about the neurobiology of being a Democrat or the neurobiology of being a Republican. Believe it or not, all of our stories are science-based, and there is actually peer-reviewed literature that discusses that, right? So those tend to be really popular and generate a lot of discussion.
That's fascinating. I mean, especially in this climate.
Yeah, right. So you could tell that he's been having a field day during this particular time.
I want to read that article.
We also have another writer who is an addiction specialist and a very good writer. And he's written about addiction as a brain disease, as opposed to what a lot of people think of addiction as just being, you know, you are weak-willed or, you know, it's a problem with your personality. And those articles have also been very popular because it helps people to have a different perspective. And, you know, with this opioid epidemic that's going on right now, a lot of people are looking for information about addiction and treatment of addiction.
Yeah, well, sounds like good information on your site. With all that content, Because you mentioned 2,000 articles at any given time. What are the challenges with maintaining your portal? And, you know, are you experiencing any challenges?
Oh, well, so I should get a PhD in running the site and in understanding this thing called search engine optimization, which is how you make sure that Google actually finds your stories, right? Because Google is king or queen, whatever you want to say. And without Google, you know, if Google doesn't like you, then your site's in trouble. So myself and my team, which is three young women, all millennials, one works about half time and the other two work one day a week, equivalent of, we spend a lot of time working on the site, making sure that we clean up problems. And, you know, Google changes what it likes. So we actually this summer went through and deleted 3,000 old stories.
Wow.
We would have done 5,000 stories, but we deleted 3,000 of them because they were too short. You know, in the old days of blogging, you could write 300 words and that was considered a blog.
Yeah.
You know, now Google wants to see things that are 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 words long. They're really more in-depth content than what was the norm back in the early days of blogging.
Exactly. And what Google wants, Google gets. You know, you mentioned something before about the difficulty getting into med school and how you were pre-med. So I noticed as I was researching you that you were the first woman to serve as president of the California chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. You were also one of the first physicians to advocate for physician training in the area of domestic violence. So maybe you could just touch on quickly before we go to break, how has being a woman in medicine changed since you first started?
Well, the change happened actually in between the first year that I applied and the second year that I got accepted, and that was called the women's movement.
Yeah.
Because the first year that I applied, the literature, you know, they could actually have in their literature of the medical school about what they were looking for, don't apply if you're over 26, right? I mean, they actually, you know, that kind of discrimination was okay, I guess. By the time I applied the second year, the women's movement was in full gear, and medical schools were starting to say, oh, we want to be the first one to have 50% women. And so there's no question in my mind that that was really why I got into medical school. Of course, there was this big influx. I think my class was maybe 20 or 25% women. And, you know, the teachers were used to teaching men, so they still did things that were, you know, sexist, both in their lectures and, you know, on the wards. But you can imagine that the first group of women who got in, that we were not shrinking violets.
Probably not.
So they had to, you know, they had to change as well. I think being a woman, you know, one of the biggest problems is that we haven't had, at least in those early days, there weren't as many mentors and role models. Right.
Yeah.
And a lot of things that happened both in medicine and I think even more in my career as a physician executive are when the guys get together and they talk about this stuff and they say things like, well, I'm going to help you get there. I'm going to, you know, write a letter for you. I'm going to, you know, they mentor each other. And women often weren't included in those conversations, which just makes it tougher because you don't know the ropes and you don't have anybody to kind of make it easier for you to get from where you are to where you want to go.
Right. You need people to guide you and mentors. I'm so glad that there are more women mentors now. Pat, I'm going to ask you just to hold your thoughts for just a moment. We're going to take a super quick break to give some love to our sponsor. And I also want to mention that Women Worldwide has joined the C-Suite Radio Network, and you can find all of our episodes on c-suiteradio.com, and be sure to check out the other great business podcasts while you're there.
You have been listening to Women Worldwide with your host, Deirdre Breckenridge. Segment 2 is coming right up.
Creating brand loyalty requires a unique blend of strategic communication and innovative technology. Pure Performance Communications works with businesses to move their audiences from awareness to action and impact by offering a digital marketing roadmap. Let us help you foster deeper engagement and forge stronger relationships along the way. Visit us at pureperformancecom.com. That's pureperformancecom with two M's.com.
Now, back to Women Worldwide with your host, Deirdre Breckenridge.
I'm Deirdre Breckenridge. Welcome back to the show. Dr. Patricia Salber and I were just chatting about her healthcare portal, The Doctor Weighs In, and her journey as a woman in medicine. So, Pat, you were just saying about how women now, there are more mentors, which is really great. And I did want to ask you a question about health and technology and the future. Where do you see all of this going?
Well, I think the technologies are going to, there are certain areas where it's going to make processes more efficient, and that's good because efficiencies mean it can drive down costs, and clearly we need to do that. I think it's also going to put a lot more DIY power into the hands of individuals because they can now do things that they perhaps would have had to go to a doctor for in the past. And I think there's just a ton going on in clever new approaches to diagnosis and treatment. So I think the contributions are going to be huge. I think we're only scratching the surface in part because people start by solving kind of the easier problems.
Right.
So we have this proliferation of step counters. Right, yeah. Which a few years ago, that was great. Wow, I could actually count my steps. Well, do you know where your step counter is right now? I don't. Because once I figured out my usual path was 10,000 steps, I didn't need to wear my step counter anymore. But I think that the future of all of this is in front of us, and we're going to see it explode over the next few years, together with other areas of innovation, such as those that are happening in genomics and personalized medicine, the things that are happening in drug development, in particular, these new targeted therapies that are turning previously fatal cancers into cancers that are survivable. So lots of exciting things coming down the path. The real question is how we're going to pay for it.
Yeah, always how we're going to pay for it. But look at how much progress we've made. And you're right, tip of the iceberg. What have you learned about being a technology entrepreneur that maybe you didn't see when you were just practicing medicine?
Well, you know, when you're practicing medicine, your total focus is on taking care of the patient in front of you. So the years that I was practicing medicine, my focus was on being sure that I knew the very latest in what was effective in the world of emergency medicine. And then when I went into the business side, I had a whole new learning process that took place around health insurance and so forth. And then on technology, obviously everything was new to me, which was part of the attraction. And, I had a lot of stuff to learn, including, the importance of, initially that some of these technology people who had come from outside of medicine were bringing a fresh look, and that was great. But part of the problem was they didn't have enough clinicians and patients to get it grounded in reality and to help them understand what was really going to make a difference and what was, something, much less important, like, I don't want to minimize step counters, but they aren't the most important thing that we could do with health technology.
Right. Well, what do you love the most about what you're doing now? And maybe, and also second part, what would you prefer just to delegate to somebody else if you could?
Well, okay. So what I like the most is you can tell, it may sound like I have a short attention span, but each of these interludes lasted, about 15 years. So I've learned that it's you can do whatever you want with a medical degree as long as you have a thirst for knowledge. You can parlay it. I have a son who's a radiologist who actually wants to move on and is even thinking about going back to school to acquire a new set of skills. And that's good because he wants to reinvigorate his enthusiasm, right?
Yeah. Has it been 15 years for him?
It's time to move? No, it's just about 15 years. Actually, it is.
Yeah. Maybe that's just a natural time to reset.
Well, I think so, because when you talk to some of the docs that are burnt out, I mean, of course, there's things like they're very discouraged by the complexity. We don't call it paperwork anymore, but the complexity of getting paid and running a practice.
Yeah.
They struggle with, you know, how much time they have to spend looking at the computer screen instead of talking to patients. You know, there are a lot of issues. And a lot of them are kind of walking in place because they don't feel financially prepared or even from a skill set prepared to move on to do something else. I recently wrote a paper about that, how to stay, you know, excited and in love with medicine throughout your whole career. And it actually was a very popular article because I think there are a lot of people, you know, who kind of wanted to hear that that's actually okay to do.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, just based on what you said about, even though you don't say it as the paperwork, sometimes being away from the patient and not being able to focus as much on the patient, that moves the doctor away from the original passion, sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, by the way, it doesn't make patients happy. And when patients aren't happy, then that also affects the doctors. I mean, they're not happy when their patients aren't happy.
Exactly. So what about being that you have a portal that is rich with lengthy and very interesting content, is there anything about running your portal that is challenging for you? Or does all of this type of technology come naturally? Now, I know you mentioned SEO, which probably doesn't come naturally to anybody unless you really apply yourself. But is there anything else that you sort of looked at and said, I wish I, you know, had taken a course on this, or maybe I just need to outsource this?
Yeah, well, I think the hardest thing is right now, this is a very expensive hobby for me, even though it's a for-profit company. It's very hard. And you know this really from the big companies, too, from, you know, the major media outlets. It's really hard to monetize content. Mm-hmm. And the ways that you can monetize content oftentimes restrict what I want to do. So, for example, we do put ads on our site. We get pitched by lots of companies who'd like to put ads on our site, for example, nutritional supplements. But we write about nutritional supplements and a lot of the problems with that industry. And we haven't really wanted to send, you know, the message that we can both, you know, that we can both write about the problems in the industry, but yet we accept industry money.
Right.
So it's made it even harder for us to be able to monetize. We tried a whole thing with sponsored content, which is a big thing, as you know, in
native advertising,
the content world.
Yep.
Yeah. And the problem was, again, you end up kind of, it kind of doesn't fit with what our mission is. What our mission is to be sure that we can provide strong evidence-based information that our readers can rely on. So I'm actually exploring whether I should convert from a for-profit to a not-for-profit. Yeah, so that I can maintain. I mean, that's what I really view our differentiation as being, is no fake science here.
Yeah. Well, just going back to what you said about the advertising, and it's also the folks who come on the portal, how much of the advertising or the sponsored content do they prefer? Will they put up with? You know, I think of some of the, you know, the videos that you see, or the video sites where you have to watch the commercial before you see the video, and then sometimes midway through there's another, you know, commercial. And you kind of wonder, how are your readers, your viewers? Do you ever get any feedback? Does anybody ever?
Oh, yeah, you know, we had pop-ups, and you know, we tried all the tricks to try and make money, you know, off our ads. And the fact is, and you've been on sites like that where I finally click away because I read a paragraph and then another pop-up comes and you read another one and you can't find a little X to X out of it. And so we do have ads and we have ads on our videos and I hate it. And I would love it if we had a way to get funded besides Pat Salver to get rid of it altogether.
No, that would be great. So you are definitely very busy, I'm sure, managing your time and prioritizing. So how do you do that? How do you look at your day to make sure that you get done everything that needs to get done?
Well, first you just reconcile yourself to working all day, every day. And when you do that, you have a whole lot more time to apply to work.
That's a really good point.
And then I do make lists, and I have a director. Her title is the director of almost everything, and she makes sure that I don't forget the really important things that I need to get done, and helps me with, you know, scheduling and staying focused, and not forgetting, for example, that I have a conversation with you today.
Yes, exactly. Now, is she virtual or is she someone who is hanging out with you?
She's sitting right here listening and laughing.
Great. Okay. Awesome.
Yeah. And one of my other employees is in Japan. For a while I had all three of them coming to the house, but one ended up going to Japan and I'm not sure when she's coming back. I mean, like, how many years from now she's coming back. And the other one went to Korea for, I think, almost a year, and then came back and got an internship at the design company IDEO.
Oh.
So, yeah, so she's really working for me virtually now, as is obviously the person in Japan.
Well, isn't it great that people can work virtually today? I have a virtual assistant. The folks who produce this podcast for me, they're all virtual. It's just, you know, I often wonder, how did we operate in the past? But,
you know, it's interesting. I wonder that too. But I think back to, you know, when I was first starting out, I actually used to play bridge at night with my friends.
Right?
You know, I mean, because we didn't have all this stuff, you know, when 5 o'clock came, you just quit, right?
Yeah.
And then you had fun, but now you can work all the time.
Right. I mean, we take a dinner break. So our kids are all older. So we have adult children. My husband and I, we take a nice dinner break, but then we find ourselves working, or I find myself writing somewhere. But that, you know, that is a part of my work. It's just really interesting. Yeah, no bridge games. I think it was, I used to play rummy with family members. Not anymore. Okay, so with all of this work, and you just said it, you know, you sort of reconcile to work all the time and every day, that, you know, you get stress. So you had stress as a physician, add in technology and being an entrepreneur, and you might as well take your stress to a whole new level. How do you handle stress?
Sure. Well, I don't feel very stressed now because I really like what I'm doing.
I'm glad.
But I have always dealt with stress with exercise. And for anybody who hasn't tried it, it's really a great stress reliever. And long hikes, or I have a personal trainer, which is actually what helps to keep me motivated. I find that the best way to deal with stress for me.
How many times do you see your personal trainer a week?
I was seeing her every day, five days a week.
Oh,
during the weekday. She's actually in the middle of an illness right now, so I'm having to motivate myself with text messages from her.
Oh, well, is that something? If you were going to go the workout route to get rid of the stress, do you need a personal trainer every day, or could you just have a personal trainer 2 days a week, or is it just, it depends on the individual and the stress level?
I think it depends on, so for me, I'll tell you the biggest thing we did about 15 years ago is we turned the guest room into a gym.
Nice.
And when you no longer have to have something, even as small as driving to the gym and parking, and the gym that I used to go to was right down the street, but all you have to do is get out of bed, put on your workout clothes, and go down to the down to your home gym.
Yeah.
That's huge. My husband works out 2 hours a day, does it just completely self-motivated. That's him, works for him. For me, having my trainer, knowing she was coming at 8:30, you know, means I had to keep 8:30 to 9:30 open, and I had to do it when she got here. So that works for me. So I think you have to play around with it. And I think the other thing that's important with respect to working out is you got to pick the activity that you like. Like, I love to walk. Mm-hmm. And I live in a beautiful area, so I can hike up in the hills. So I love that. But if you said to me, Pat, no, walking's bad, you really ought to swim every day, I wouldn't work out.
Yeah, no, you have to do what you like. And then I guess you'd have to put the equipment in your home gym of the things that you like to do. So maybe if you didn't get out to walk, I'd prefer walking in the hills any day to a treadmill, but maybe you put a treadmill in the gym on the days that you can't get to the hills.
Yeah, exactly. We have a treadmill, an elliptical, and free weights. So it's not like we have a ton of equipment, but we have, and then of course yoga mats. So we have enough to support whatever it is that we want to do.
Well, no wonder why you're not stressed. And I'll take a lesson from you, Pat. Absolutely. Okay, what advice would you give to other professionals who just want to take their career in a new direction to a higher level, or it's 15 years in and they need a reset? What would you say to them?
I think if you're 15 years in and you need a reset, then be brave, explore what you want to do, and do it. Hanging in there for 30 years when the last 15 aren't fun anymore is really not a good use of your time. And I'm going to speak specifically to people who have an MD. There are so many things you can do with that knowledge. The degree helps, and it ranges all the way from practicing medicine to doing public health to, you know, I know doctors who've gone and worked in the stock market and they help evaluate, you know, companies related to healthcare. There are just so many different things that you can do that allow you to take that knowledge and that degree and apply it in new ways to help people and to have fun with medicine.
That's awesome. Great advice for professionals and especially doctors or those with medical degrees. Last question, super easy. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
Sure, they can go to the drwaysin.com. They can see all our stories. And if you click on About, you can read my bio.
Excellent. Pat, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show to share your career journey. It was really interesting and to share all of your insights on health and being a tech entrepreneur. So thank you.
Thank you.
And I also want to thank all of you for tuning into Women Worldwide. Until our next episode, stay focused, energized, and feeling empowered. Thanks.